Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're having a chat about the history of history. To celebrate the 300th episode of this Tin Pot History podcast, I still can't quite believe we're here. I had so many people independently suggesting that I talk about the history of history to mark this occasion. It was unbelievable. A ton of listeners all emailing in with the same suggestion. So unless there's a great big half-assed history hive mind out there, it's very clear that people are keen to hear about this topic. And I'm happy to do it after so long, after so many episodes. I wanted to find something a little more special to mark the 300th episode of this podcast. It staggers me that we've made it as far as we had. When I started the show out just as a little hobby, I never anticipated that it would grow to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of listeners all around the world. I didn't expect to be organizing live shows, trying to get a book published. And also, I will say, some announcements coming at the end of this show, including one that I didn't anticipate being able to announce. Last week, I sort of teased some of the stuff that's coming this week. There's something else I didn't expect to get across the line in time for episode 300, but it's coming. So make sure you stick around for all the boring housekeeping stuff coming at the end of the show, because some stuff that I'm very, well, at least somewhat excited to unveil to you all. Anyway, doing this episode, researching the history of history, oh boy, it was a challenging topic to tackle, because history as a discipline, right, it is so expansive, it's so far-reaching, it's so all-encompassing that distilling it all down to a single podcast episode was very difficult indeed, and also not really something I managed to do when it comes to the regular time frame of this episode, as you can tell by looking at its length already. You'll be able to tell that, I say it every single week, don't I? A lot to get across, and this week it is truer than ever before. But this week we are going to talk about the way in which we as a species have recorded our own history across thousands and thousands of years, and examining the way that historians applied their trade over the centuries is a discipline in and of itself. It's called historiography. It is the study of history as an academic discipline. And so as a result of this, attempting to deliver a history of historiography is just a head-spinningly self-referential task, because in doing something like this, in making this episode, right, the field of historiography becomes a little bigger, because this work is in itself historiographical. So, yeah. I've done my best, right? I've done my best, and of course, if this episode ends up being rubbish, I've very cleverly got my excuse baked into the title of the show, don't I? So you're not going to be able to get me on that one. But I do want to thank all of the alert listeners that got in touch to suggest this topic. Lots of people very keen for it. Anna Fitz, John Moody, Michael, Paul Kaskamanidis, Tobias Jesper Anderson, James, Matthew Tapley, James Konu, MacGyver, Fergus Eyre, Balkan Sillinger, Kim Jorgensen, Thomas Fried, Frederick Babin, and anyone else who I didn't manage to find after combing through the hundreds of emails I received. So thank you very, very much to everyone who got in touch. All of these people that I mentioned, perhaps even more, requested a history of history. And many of them suggested that I talk about Herodotus, often referred to as the father of history. It's actually him on the podcast logo in his, you know, his cool and extremely historically accurate sunglasses. And look, while we will have a brief chat about Herodotus today, I want to direct your attention to the upcoming Quarter Asked History episode 51, which will be a more detailed look at Herodotus, his life and times, and the contributions, more specifically, that he made to historiography. As I say, we'll only be chatting about him a little bit today because there is just so much other stuff to talk about. But not much in the way, I should warn you, of blood and guts and horrible murder this week. I know that has become a half-ass history staple, but this week there's not so much that as there is just words and then more words. A fair whack of words coming your way. The longest episode I have ever recorded, but it's my great pleasure to do so. It's my great pleasure to bring you episode 300 of Half-Assed History. So let's not fiddly-fart around any longer. Let's begin at last. This 300th episode, a half-assed history of history itself. We're going all the way back here. We're going all the way back to the year 430 BCE, when our good friend Herodotus invented history by publishing a book very appropriately called Histories. Now, before that, of course, there was no such thing as history. Every day, people got up and they just forgot who they were and where they were and what they were doing. They just, you know, really lived in the moment, kind of like how we could all fly around through the sky, untethered by the cruel earth below, before bloody Sir Isaac Newton comes along and invents gravity, causing us all to crash down to the ground forever. Bloody bastard, episode 216, get across it. No, obviously this isn't the case. Of course not. No. As important as Herodotus is in the history of history, history did not begin with this bloke. Even before we figured out how to write stuff down, humans told and retold stories. Stories about the world, stories about gods and heroes, and of course, stories about themselves and the things that they did. Now, humans as a species, we're pretty big fans of ourselves, generally speaking. There's nothing most people like more than just, you know, talking about themselves. So history as a concept is a foundational aspect of our very humanity, really. And as a practical discipline, history has developed independently across virtually every single human civilization that ever existed. It seems that we as a species have a profound need to understand and to feel connected to our past. And not just an individual person's past either. An individual's past helps them to define who they are, to understand themselves, to learn and to grow and to improve. But there's so much more to our connection to the past than just our own personal individual stories. We don't just seek to contextualize ourselves as individuals, but also our sense of belonging to a greater whole, whether that's to a family, a tribe, clan, culture, or nation, or to a group of people with shared ideas and values, or honestly, as an entire species all together. And this is what history is about. Understanding, analyzing, and contextualizing human civilization through the lens of where we've been, so as to better understand where we are and where we're going. And as you can imagine, this is something that we've been doing since we could even conceive of such notions, for a time far outside the bounds of traditional historical study. Around flickering fires, early humans developed language with the sharing of stories, of myths and legends, of tales of family and forebears. History, in other words, in its most rudimentary and basic form, history has necessarily been with us since our beginnings as a sentient, sapient species. But interestingly, we don't often acknowledge this when speaking of history formally as an academic discipline. In fact, we do the complete opposite, because we label this era of early humanity as being prehistoric, before history. And the line between prehistoric times and, I guess, I don't know, historic times, the line that is drawn generally between prehistory and history, in an academic sense at least, is the invention of writing. The invention of writing is, of course, one of the most important events to have ever taken place in human civilization, and not just for the academic discipline of history, but it does tend to mark the formal boundary between prehistory and recorded history. When we started to write things down, this is when history is said to have begun. However, there are a lot of issues with this definition, and while I'm happy to stick to it when we talk about the formal and the academic discipline of historical study, there are a couple of things I want to point out before we get into that, right? Because using the invention of writing as a watershed dividing prehistory and history means that prehistory ended at very different times depending on where you are in the world, right? In formal terms, prehistory lasted a lot longer in some places compared to others. For instance, the earliest writing systems are thought to have been developed over 5,000 years ago. Still, obviously, a lot of disagreement between what is writing and what is proto-writing, but around the 4th millennium BCE, this is generally agreed upon as the time that humanity entered the era of history, moving on from prehistory. But again, this is fraught with issues because this the development of writing didn't take place at the same time all around the world. And if history doesn't exist without writing, does that mean that the history of Australia, for instance, only goes back as far as the late 18th century with the arrival of European settlers and the writing that they had, I guess, unlocked from the technology tree? No, of course not. Indigenous Australian history goes back tens of thousands of years, just as all human history does. The fact that it wasn't written down doesn't mean that it never existed in the first place. And this is why I talk about stories told around flickering fires, because that is history. It's not recorded history, it's not formal history, it's not written history, but it's history all the same. When you get home after work and complain about your boss, that's history. When you call your mum and she tells you about, you know, the lovely dinner she had the other day, that's history. And when you sit down and quietly think to yourself about the things that you've learned, the ways that you've grown as a person, even that is history. History is the relationship that we have with our past. And this might sound like nonsense, this might sound like a cop-out, but it is so much more than just facts and figures and names and dates. I'm not going to sit here and insult the histories of countless billions of humans just because those histories were never written down. However, to make this episode actually, you know, listenable and not just an hour and a bit of abstract high concept wank, we do have to narrow the aperture a little bit here. And so now with a clear understanding that this is not all there is to history, we'll get underway with the history now of recorded history, which I feel is a much better term to use when talking about the division brought about by the invention of writing. And to begin our history of recorded history, we go all the way back to the old world, to these ancient civilizations living thousands and thousands of years ago, the ones in which early writing systems first flourished. In places like Egypt, in Mesopotamia, and Sumeria, and Akkadia, people began to write things down, all sorts of things, from codes of laws to, famously, complaints about the quality of copper shipments. But they also began to write down history, yes, certainly, but again, not as you would think about it in a formal academic sense. Because early historical documents were what we call chronologies. They were essentially timelines, annals. They were very plain and simple documents that outlined events that had taken place in the order in which they had taken place. There was no narrative, there was no analysis, there was no reflection. Just a very simply structured factual sequence of events, essentially a dot point list. And as such, even these records are often excluded from the story of historiography, strictly speaking, because they don't analyze or interpret or synthesize information. They just present it. And look, there's nothing wrong with that. It is still extremely valid history, very useful history, of course, but there's a reason that the story of history, if you like, is often said to have begun with Herodotus and his famous work, Histories, because it was in Greece in the 5th century BCE that history began to emerge as a structured, methodical, and systematized discipline. In contrast to the stories told around the flickering fire or the dry chronological annals of early civilizations, People like Herodotus instead began to seek a more specific purpose in addressing the past. And this was the birth of history. Formal history, recorded history, written history. And as Herodotus got there first, he is known as the father of history. And also as the father of lies, I should mention, by his many detractors. But again, we'll address all that in and much more in the upcoming episode of Quarter Hour's History. So don't you worry about it. Make sure to get across that. Anyway, Herodotus, he was the first to write and publish what is known as a critical analysis of history. More than write down just what had happened, he also analysed what it meant, why it was important, and what was to be learnt from it. Herodotus travelled and researched extensively in writing works like his histories, and he gave broadly accurate accounts of events like the Greco-Persian Wars, for instance, episodes 184 to 186 get across them. And in my view, at least, and I guess, you know, you're probably going to be able to sense the enormous level of personal bias I have in making this statement, but in my view, history remains one of the most important works of literature in the world because it essentially founded a discipline. History was, at last, formalized and systematized. And here we are, almost 2,500 years later, still following in the footsteps of Herodotus. So thanks, Herodotus, old mate, for opening this door for us. Thanks for appearing on the cover of my Tin Pot History podcast every week. I do love those sunnies. If you can't tell, I'm a huge fan of this bloke. I've got a little statue of him in my study and everything. I'm a massive fan of Herodotus. And again, make sure to come back for the next episode of Quarter Hour's History as we talk a lot more about his life and times. Anyway, Herodotus and other historians of his time, they began a new approach, right, to recording history. Instead of just writing down timelines, chronologies, annals, dot points, whatever you want to call them, they used narrative. They considered and investigated a wide range of sources in pulling together the works that they produced. And other Greek historians developed further the techniques and the approaches that Herodotus had kicked off. Thucydides, for instance, unlike Herodotus, he wrote strictly rationalist histories. He wouldn't entertain the notion of divine intervention in human affairs, unlike Herodotus, who sometimes was happy enough to chalk certain events up to meddlesome gods. But Thucydides, on the other hand, he established the historical technique of drawing links between cause and effect. Not just this thing happened, we don't really know why, but this thing happened, here's why it happened, and as a result, here's what else happened later on. And this may sound very, very simple, but this is one of the most important aspects of history as an academic discipline. It's not just about telling stories, but also learning from those stories, understanding those stories on a deeper level. In any case, early historians like Herodotus, like Thucydides, they established history as an immensely important part of Greek culture, with notable historians like Polybius, Diodorus Siculus, and plenty of others following in their footsteps, producing historical works of great importance. And then, in the time that followed, as was the case with most aspects of Greek culture, to be honest, history as a discipline, as an academic and cultural pursuit, was pinched by the Romans as they rose to dominate the Mediterranean, and there are plenty of immensely famous Roman historians whose chronicles allow us to examine and analyze and learn from the Roman Republic and then later the Roman Empire. Plutarch, Suetonius, Tacitus, Livy, even Julius Caesar himself, episode 205, get across it, all of these historians made immensely important contributions to historiography and, in Caesar's case, actual just history as well. But the Roman approach to history, or Roman historiography, in other words, it had its own style to set it apart from Greek historiography. Now, historiography refers to the study of the way that history is recorded, right? It's an analysis of the activities of historians across the broad scope of human history. But it can also be used as a term to describe the way in which a particular group or subset of historians recorded history. So, for instance, Greek historiography, the way that Greek historians wrote down Greek history, is different from Roman historiography, the way that Roman historians wrote down and recorded Roman history. So what a lot of this episode is going to be about, to be honest with you, is comparing and contrasting the different historiographical approaches of these historians from different places and different times in history. And so to begin this comparison, we can start off very simply by talking about the differences between Greek historians and Roman historians and some of the consequences for historiography as an entire discipline, if you like. We'll get into this in a little bit more detail later on in the show, but I guess the way that I want to set the stage for that discussion is you need to think about historiography and the way that we record history, the way that this has developed over the years, in the same way that we've developed and advanced many other aspects of our civilization. For instance, we're better at, I don't know, art now than we ever have been. We're better at building houses than we've ever been. We're better at science and technology, and we're just more advanced on so many axes these days than we were thousands of years ago. And it might sound weird to talk about the way that we record history being more advanced now than it was back then, but that is absolutely definitely the case. We'll talk more about it as we've sort of got more of an understanding of the way that historiography has changed over the years under our belts later on the episode. But for now, I just want you to remember that what we're talking about here is not just the differences in the ways that, I don't know, the Greeks and the Romans recorded their history, but the way in which historians wrote history down changed and, broadly speaking, improved over the centuries. But it wasn't always improvements, as we'll talk about a little bit here when it came to Roman historiography, because while the Romans obviously adopted many of the Greek aspects to historiography, and while many Roman texts are enormously instructive and very useful and very, very important in our understanding of this place and this period in time, many Roman historians were also concerned not just with what happened and what it meant, but also sought to impart moral lessons with their works as well. And this has led to some highly unobjective texts being produced around this time, because these historians would slant their work with their own personal biases and beliefs about what was or what was not moral and correct. Not that I can talk. Obviously, who am I to talk? I'm filling this podcast with all my bleeding heart, lefty, woke, liberal nonsense. I can't go about throwing stones in this particular glass house. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, and this is important to remember when addressing any historical text, from an ancient Roman publication to, I don't know, a tin pot history podcast in the 21st century, there is always an agenda that historians are attempting to pursue with the work that they produce, whether that is attempting to provoke a change in your thinking or nudge your moral worldview in a certain direction, or honestly, just entertain and delight you with stories from the past, it's very, very difficult to present history objectively. It's very, very difficult to just lay down the facts. You can attempt to, but then invariably you become reductive or, worse, boring. So there are lots of very nuanced issues when it comes to the presentation of history that we will talk about throughout the rest of this episode, as we talk about how historians have attempted to address these issues and attempted to, in some cases, mitigate them, in some cases, embrace them. But to bring it back to what we were talking about with the Romans when it comes to using history as a vehicle for moral instruction, while this dominated Roman history and Roman historiography, it certainly wasn't unique to Rome. Because I want to talk to you now about another place where this same approach to history, very similar approach to history, using it as a vehicle for moral instruction, was also developing independently, half a world away from Rome, in ancient China, as formal recorded history began to take off there as well. In the late 2nd and early 1st centuries BCE, a bloke by the name of Sima Qian emerged as something of a Herodotus of the East, I guess you could say, with a work called Shiji. Now, earlier Chinese civilizations had annals and chronicles, just as Mesopotamia had, but they didn't have proper formalized written history in the same sense as we were talking about with Herodotus and his histories. And interestingly, it's no coincidence that some of the first places for written histories to emerge were also, you know, the places where writing first emerged. Mesopotamia and China are two of the three places where writing was invented independently. The third place, of course, is Mesoamerica, the only other region to develop a writing system independently. For such a For such a fundamentally crucial human invention, we only actually got around to inventing writing three times in total: Mesopotamia, China, and then Mesoamerica. The most famous Mesoamerican writing system, the Maya script, it emerged by at least the 3rd century BCE. They got to it a little bit later than other parts of the world, but hey, they got there and that's what counts. Unfortunately, however, I can't give you a full account of Maya historiography because most of the sources I found on the topic were in Spanish, but the fact that they invented writing so early on meant that we have a much better understanding of their ancient civilization than we would have otherwise, because like humans everywhere, the Maya valued their own history. They were fortunate enough, however, to be able to write it down. But back to China now for the time being. As I say, they had their annals, they had their chronicles with documents like the spring and autumn annals dating back to the 5th century BCE. But then Sima came along and revolutionized historiography in China, just as Herodotus had done in Greece. And his work Shiji, or Records of the Grand Historian, as it's also sometimes known, it was the Chinese equivalent of histories. And in its own way, Chinese historiography differed enormously from its Greek and Roman counterparts. Sima established a historiographical tradition that focused less on narrative, as we saw in Greek and Roman historical text, and more on specific, I guess, chapters, you would call them, individual sections, self-contained, that were written about individual people or places or events. And this is in stark contrast to the cause and effect approach of the Greeks. But it did also allow for the moral instruction that was found in Roman historiography. Because in writing discrete chapters on individual leaders, Chinese historians could, if and when the political climate called for it, offer analysis and evaluation of that leader's aptitude and offer the reader some very firm conclusions about the leader's conduct and their morality. And moral analysis played a very big part in Chinese history, especially as the Chinese cycled through various ruling dynasties. Leaders from new dynasties sought to paint their fallen predecessors as immoral, as unsuitable for leadership, and then, of course, paint themselves as morally righteous and very much deserving of the power that they had. A great many notable Chinese historians wrote a great many notable works, but perhaps the most important of Chinese historians, after, of course, Sima Qian, is the father-son duo of Lu Xiang and Lu Xin, who worked as imperial librarians heading into the Common Era. These two organized, reformatted, edited, and systematized a vast collection of historical works in China, although tragically, much of the work that they did was destroyed when the imperial library was burnt down by arsonists in 190 CE. But nonetheless, a culture of historical output was very firmly entrenched in China, but remained very chapter-focused, divided up very neatly, usually done along the lines of dynasties, as I mentioned, as these dynasties came and went. And the end result was something called the 24 Histories, which covers the vast expanse of Chinese history, starting all the way back with Sima Qian in 91 BCE, and concluding, after 24 volumes, with Zhang Tingyu's history of the Ming dynasty, which was finally published in 1739. Although we are getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, talking about the 24 histories and its conclusion in the 18th century. So before we race too far forward here, let's set a rather more stately pace and talk about the development of Chinese historiography into the medieval period and how some of the methodology that emerged there would go on to become very important in historiography in later years. There are many aspects and approaches and traditions and techniques that were established in Chinese medieval historiography that we still use today, as we'll talk about. But I want to talk to you about a historian by the name of Liu Ziji, who in 710 CE published something called the Shitong, the first ever Chinese work on historiography itself. So, this wasn't a historical chronicle. It wasn't a work of history. It wasn't recording the stories of people and the things that they did. No, this was a critical analysis of the body of Chinese historical works so far. And it was a very important one too, because it contains some elements of historiography that are, as I'm sure you'll agree once I enumerate them for you, absolutely essential. Lu Zhiji established some views on how history should be recorded, assessed, and evaluated. Some of these views have been very influential in the field of historiography, and some of them are, well, some are very interesting, as we'll get into here. Firstly, in the Shitong, Liu laid out the historiographical principle of not blindly relying on primary sources alone. Now, in case you've forgotten your, you know, civic studies or your SOS classes from when you were a kid in school, let's briefly talk here. Well, I say briefly. Let's talk here about what historical sources are, the different types of historical sources that exist, and the ways in which they can be used and the ways in which they perhaps shouldn't be used, right? So firstly, a primary source. A primary source is a source that comes directly from the historical period being studied. So an example of a primary source would be the diary kept by Anne Frank if you were studying the Holocaust. Young Anne saw what happened during the Holocaust with her own eyes. She wrote about it and ultimately then became a victim of it. So when studying the Second World War, when studying the Holocaust, the diary of Anne Frank becomes a primary source. A secondary source, by contrast, is a source that discusses or evaluates or investigates or otherwise expands upon primary sources. So a good example of a secondary historical source is this podcast. It's a secondary source. It's something that I make after reading other sources, some primary, some secondary. But here's what's interesting. A source can be both primary and secondary. And the reason that I use Anne Frank's diary as an example of a primary source is that it is also a secondary source. Let me explain. It is a primary source in that it contains the an account of the lived experience of a Jew during the Holocaust, but it also contains her thoughts on historical events that were happening at the time, like the forced deportation of Jews from Amsterdam, the potential involvement of Turkey in the Second World War, the consequences of the Battle of Stalingrad, a potential Allied invasion of the continent, and so much more. And so as a result, it is also a secondary source because when she was writing this diary, Anne Frank was considering primary sources at the time. Newspaper reports of a potential Allied landing in the continent, for instance, and then providing her own perspective and her own thoughts on these historical events, these primary sources. And therefore, it is, rather confusingly, I guess, perhaps, a secondary source at the same time as being a primary source. And look, honestly, plenty of things can be both primary and secondary source at the same time. Typically, it's things like newspaper articles, government documentation, even something like a TV documentary can be both of these things. But then, oh boy, I don't want to get you too excited here, but just you wait until I tell you about tertiary sources as well. Oh yes, we're really getting stuck in here. Tertiary sources, can you believe your luck? We get to talk about them as well. They do exist, they are a thing, but they actually tend to be the most boring of the lot out of primary, secondary, tertiary sources. Tertiary sources certainly very dull, because they tend to be things like compendiums, indexes, encyclopedic lists, databases, almanacs, that sort of thing. They don't so much involve information itself, but information about information, just in case, you know, this episode wasn't already self-referential enough. But the reason I wanted to talk to you about sources and the different distinctions between them is that sources are, of course, the single most important thing in the discipline of history. Because without sources, you're not a historian. You're just, I don't know, an author, which is not a terrible thing to be by any means. I wish I was one. Can't get a bloody book deal, mate. But without sources, you don't have history. You've just got your imagination. And so to bring it back to old mate Liu Zhiji here, you might be surprised to find out that he was actually very cautious when it came to historians just purely basing their work on primary sources alone. And this may seem very confusing at first blush. You're thinking, well, why? Aren't primary sources the best possible sources to use, as they are the most authentic, the most legitimate source of historical information? Well, yes and no. They are, in some ways, they are obviously a very important part of historical research. They offer unparalleled insight into objective historical fact. However, as Liu advises, you have to be very, very cautious about their use in historical research because primary sources are very often biased or incomplete or subjective or narrow. very few people who create primary sources aren't doing so deliberately. They're not doing so with an awareness of the historical impact of what they make. They don't make primary sources with the grand sweep of history in mind. They're just living their lives, doing what they do, writing what they write, making what they make, without thinking that they're leaving behind primary sources. I'll give you an example, right? Okay. Let's say that you listening to this right now, let's say that you somehow become a historical figure of great renown. I don't know how. Let's say, I don't know, you're the first person on Mars or something, right? Someone that everyone wants to know about now. So your life, it's picked apart. It's studied. Everything you've said, everything you've written down, everything that you've made, it is now a primary source offering historians a glimpse into the details of your life. So that one email that you sent that one time to that one colleague who was pissing you off, and really, I mean, you really know you shouldn't have sent it. You know you shouldn't have, but you had a couple of jars. Wasn't your finest moment, and it was pretty funny seeing their face the next day. Some of the language you use, oh boy, lucky they never brought it up with the boss. Hey, so imagine now, right, that a historian accesses that email that you sent as a primary source, and this historian uses this email and it alone to make and support the claim that you, the first person on Mars, were a difficult, belligerent, and abusive colleague, not to mention a bit of a drunkard to boot. Now, is that an accurate depiction of you, the first person on Mars? Probably not. I certainly hope not, in any case, but historians can and do overuse primary sources to confirm their own biases. They cherry-pick evidence that supports whatever point they're trying to make based on what can be, as I mentioned before, narrow or incomplete or decontextualized primary sources. Now, I'm guilty of this. I know I am. I can remember in writing this podcast, I will churn through pages and pages of quotes by whoever I'm looking at that week to find the one that's going to be the most entertaining on the podcast. I'll sift out parts of primary sources that aren't relevant, in my view, to whatever I'm talking about. Now, this isn't hugely malicious of me, but it's still not an ideal way to go about creating a balanced and objective historical record. I can try to justify my approach to my use of primary sources by saying that this podcast is meant to entertain first and educate second. But does that make it okay for me to use primary sources in this way? I don't know. Honestly, I don't. And if you were to accuse me of being a shonky historian as a result, I would wear it. And again, it's right there in the name of the podcast, mate. So, you know, what do you want from me? Anyway, the reason that primary sources can be dangerous to the historian is that they often result in an incomplete picture or one with a significant slant or bias. And especially with old primary sources, they are enormously open to misinterpretation. They often require a huge amount of contextual knowledge in order to be analysed properly. So, once again, to bring it back to poor old Lu Zhiji, I'm so sorry, mate, he's been waiting so patiently. He recognised the pitfalls that historians can fall into when dealing with primary sources. And so he contributed greatly to historiography by warning us to exercise care and consideration when working with them. Because intuitively, you would think primary sources, fantastic. These are the things that you definitely want to always be using when creating historical output. But Liu taught us that a level of care and caution is required when doing so. Liu also made several other important contributions to historiography in his work, The Shitong, namely that results-oriented analysis is usually inherently flawed. Another principle that may seem a little counterintuitive to begin with, but once you actually think about it, it does make a lot of sense. You can't always judge a decision on its outcome because it's entirely possible to make completely correct decisions and still end up with a negative outcome, as many listeners will already know all too well. So much more goes into the evaluation of people and their decisions than just the results that those decisions generated. And the Shitong makes it clear that historians should look beyond results when assessing history. Again, another principle that may not seem to make a lot of sense. Well, of course, you judge decisions that people make based on the effects that they had. Sometimes it's not the best thing to do that because it doesn't give you the clearest or the most comprehensive picture of the entire situation. And additionally, and somewhat radically here, the Shitong also strongly advises historians, and also people more broadly, not to blindly accept established ideas or ways of thinking. Just because something is so and has always been so, it doesn't mean that it's right. Just because a historian said something, it doesn't make it true, no matter how famous or esteemed or, you know, handsome or funny they are. So this one these days, certainly a little more obvious, I would think. It essentially boils down to just, you know, don't believe everything you hear, although there are plenty of people these days who still struggle with that very basic concept. And as basic as it may sound, it was important that Liu put it in the Shitong and I guess gave people the idea to think about things in this way. It gave people almost permission to think about things in this way, to discard old, outdated ideas and not just rely on the thought that, well, I don't know, it's always been like that, or, oh, it was, you know, written a long time ago, it's probably true. These are things that you need to keep in mind when evaluating, not just historical texts, but everything altogether more broadly. So, honestly, good on you, Liu, old mate. The Shitong is a terrific bit of historiography. Quite aside from its importance to the discipline, it also gave me an excuse to talk about the relative merits of historical source classifications. Oh, baby. I hope it was as good for the listener as it was for me. Anyway, let's crack on here and zoom out from China to talk about the development of historiography very briefly in other parts of Asia as well. For instance, in Japan, where formal historical works date back to the 7th century CE with the attribution of Japan's foundational historical texts, the Tennoki and the Koki, to a bloke named Prince Shotoku. Japanese historiography was very heavily influenced by its Chinese counterpart. The Chinese knew a thing or two about history by that stage. They'd been doing it a while. But Japanese historiography soon developed its own aspects, especially into the second millennium. And specifically, Japanese historical works began to prize elegant and expressive narrative prose, in contrast to the discontinuous and dynasty-based style of Chinese historical writing. And additionally, much Japanese history was also recorded and expressed not just in works of narrative prose, but in art and in theatre and in poetry. But this much more expressive approach to historical records came at a steep cost, a loss of accuracy, as storytelling trumped truthfulness and exactness a lot of the time in Japanese historiography. And so much of Japan's historical work is, as we explored a little bit in last week's episode of Quarter Hour's History, interwoven with fictional elements, with myth and legend. Korean historiography, it's got its own quirks as well. Again, initially heavily influenced by Chinese historiography, Korean historical works developed to become a political tool of the ruling royal class. Old Korean history strongly focuses on the role that royals played and is usually very complimentary and positive about royal governance, particularly during the 5th century rule of the Joseon dynasty. Korean national identity has always been strongly underpinned by its history and its historical traditions, and even today, with the Korean peninsula riven in two, Korean nationalism is heavily reflected in its historical works, particularly during the period it was colonized by the Japanese. But we'll come back to the role of nationalism in historiography a little bit later on in the episode, and for now continue our exploration of medieval historiography as we move west now into the Middle East, where the rise of Islam in the early 7th century would bring about further shifts in historiographical techniques, some of them very important, some of them beneficial, but not all of them as positive as those that had come previously. An enormous part of Islamic historiography is concerned with something called hadith, a record of the deeds and the statements of Muhammad, the Muslim prophet who founded the religion, and more specifically, the legitimacy or the authenticity of a given hadith, as hadith is the basis of Islamic law. Islamic historians spent much of their focus and energy essentially reconstructing the life of Muhammad, who was a real person who actually existed, of course, just like Jesus. But also like Jesus, there is a lot of myth and legend and unverifiable fiction built into the story of Muhammad. A very rigorous system was developed by Islamic scholars and historians to evaluate aspects of their history, so as to put potentially authentic hadith to the test, to affirm something as having been genuinely said or done by Muhammad himself. And that's all well and good. I'm obviously strongly in favour of historical rigour, but given how much of Muhammad's story is, as is the case with most religious prophets, supernatural, and therefore, empirically speaking, fictional, I think it's a shame that so much of this historical rigour was and still is used in the examination of a heavily fictionalised biography. And the same can be said of Christian historians investigating the life of Jesus and attempting to reconcile Jesus, the real-life person, with his role in the vast scope of Christian mythology. But we'll come to Christendom in due course. In the Islamic world, while its historiography was established with a firmly religious bent, Islamic historians nonetheless developed the discipline in other much more important and beneficial ways, no doubt thanks to the fact that there was this culture of rigour when investigating the veracity, the authenticity of history. But this wasn't the only very positive aspect of historiography that emerged during the medieval period in the Islamic world, because Islamic historians also wrote extensively on cultural history and social history, philosophical history, scientific history. It wasn't just kings and dynasties, warlords and battles. It wasn't just political and military history. People would write about the histories of concepts and ideas, artistic or social movements, the way that we as humans had changed in our thinking over the centuries. And this was a very important direction for history as an academic discipline, and one that, in my view, the discipline still needs a lot more of these days. Even today, history is seen by so many as boring, as just, you know, facts and figures and names and dates and kings and queens and battles and wars, but it's so much more than that, as Islamic historians such as Ibn Khaldun showed us with his works on cultural history. But Khaldun's works not just important because of the nature of the history that he explored, he also made some critical improvements and advancements to the field of historiography. His approach to historical analysis was extremely advanced for the time. Khaldun was someone that questioned everything and took nothing for granted, meaning that his works were almost scientific in their approach to establishing historical truth. In his seminal work, Muqaddimah, he explicitly rejected the inclusion of unverifiable myth in history, and he laid out something of a historical method, I guess you could call it, that advised historians on best practices and how to avoid common critical mistakes. And when you think about doing something like excluding unverifiable myth from history, it's made even more remarkable when you remember just how dominated Islamic historiography was by religious myth and legend. So Khaldun was ahead of his time, certainly. He investigated and wrote on topics such as history as propaganda, systemic bias within history, and the importance of verifiability. And again, we talked about this a little bit when talking about Liu Zhiji. Ideas like don't believe everything you read might sound obvious to us these days. Again, well, I guess most of us, Khaldun continued to help to establish this as another foundational aspect of historiography. And I go through this process constantly when I make this podcast. I can't tell you the number of times when researching that I've come across a really cool or a really funny story. It's going to be great, fantastic. This is going to make a great episode. I can't wait to talk about this. And then, of course, I do my due diligence. I check with other sources to verify the story, make sure it's true, and find that it is not. It is apocryphal, or it's exaggerated, or it has just been made up. But then sometimes just chuck it in anyway, because, you know, it's a good story. Always with the disclaimer that it's probably not true or it's apocryphal. You probably heard me say these sorts of things in previous episodes, right? I will clearly warn you when we're not on a firm historical footing with what I'm talking about. But I guess, yeah, look, I'll have to cop to the fact that I really am a shonky historian, just letting down people like Ibn Khaldun. I'm so sorry, old mate. Anyway, in addition to Khaldun, there were other Islamic historians of the medieval period who put forth groundbreaking works because of the nature of these works. There were historians at this time and this place that wrote on world history, attempting to synthesize and present historical information on a scale as yet unseen. Historians like Muhammad ibn Jarir al-Tabari and Abu al-Hasan Ali al-Madusi, who lived in the 9th and 10th centuries respectively, they published great works of unprecedented scope. Al-Tabari's History of the Prophets and Kings, for instance, it chronicles not just Islamic history, but the history of the Middle East and of the Mediterranean. It goes all the way back to the ancient world and also, you know, to the Old Testament and stuff like Noah and his Ark. So again, the lines get a little blurry between history and mythology there. But I do want to point out here, before we keep heading west into Europe and the Christian medieval world, that medieval Islamic historiography had a colossal impact on history as an academic discipline, both at the time and in the centuries that followed. For instance, many ancient texts that have survived to this day from places like ancient Greece, right? They're only still around these days because of the interest taken in them by Islamic historical scholars. They translated these texts into Arabic, only for these translations to make their way into Europe in later centuries, to be translated into Latin and then other languages and disseminated far and wide thanks to inventions like the printing press, episode 217, get across it. So the culture of history established in the Islamic world during the medieval period, the interest that Islamic historians took in aspects of history beyond their own leaders and realms, which wasn't something that a lot of civilizations did before this helped to preserve an incalculable wealth of knowledge for future generations. Thanks to the influence of Islamic scholarship, historiography became more advanced and more developed than ever before. It became more rigorous, more systematized, more scientific, broader in scope, and it has played a crucial role in shaping modern historical thinking. I know it's weird to think about history and historiography in this way, because like if I want to tell you about the development of, I don't know, scientific advancement, right? It's easier. It's easier to pinpoint specific tangible things that serve as markers for progress. Oh, here's the guy who figured out how gravity works, episode 216, get across it. Here's the guy who saved billions of lives with the discovery of penicillin, episode 151, get across it. But we're on a much more conceptual level with developments in historiography. You can't see them, you can't touch them. Experiencing historiographical progress isn't like experiencing technological progress, right? Once they were invented, you could sit on a bicycle, episode 162, or a flushing toilet, episode 139, and you could marvel at how far we'd advanced as a species with the tangible results of scientific and technological progress. But historiography and its advancements are intangible. They are abstract. They're conceptual. And so talking about them in this way, it sounds a little strange. But here's the thing. As obvious as you may find statements such as don't believe everything you read and double check your sources to verify something, these are cornerstones of historical investigation and more broadly just good common sense, someone had to come up with these concepts in the first place. I'll give you another example here to try to illustrate the point that I'm making here, right? Something that is conceptual that these days we all just take for granted as being very simple, straightforward, and obvious, negative numbers. Historically speaking, you may be interested to learn, negative numbers represented an abstract, conceptual, and impossibly complex mathematical idea. In China, India, and the Middle East, early mathematicians grappled with negative numbers, attempting to understand them and fit them into mathematical orthodoxy. But they were, as I say, head-swimmingly difficult to comprehend. After all, right? Two apples plus three apples, that's five apples, right? That's fine. Easy peasy. I can handle that. Two apples minus three apples? How can you have less than zero apples? This doesn't make any sense at all. In Europe, most notably, right, mathematicians refused to accept negative numbers as part of mainstream mathematics until the mid-19th century. They were purely conceptual, they said. They were nonsense. These numbers aren't worth thinking about. They can't be understood. Today, in primary schools, we teach negative numbers to kids in grade 4. These are 9 and 10-year-olds who understand that you can count backwards past 0, even if you can't have minus 1 apples. And the point I'm trying to make with this here is that it's easy to marvel at an invention, a discovery, a thing, to look at it and to go, wow, that is a clever bit of thinking right there. But it's much harder to think about thinking in the same way, to recognize and evaluate conceptual advancement. Even with a 10-year-old's basic understanding of negative numbers, you become more advanced than the cleverest 18th century European mathematicians when it comes to the functions of basic numerical integers. These concepts that seem so easy for us to understand today, that seem so obvious, someone had to come up with them in the first place. And when they did, chances are, like with negative numbers, they weren't as simple then as they are now. It took years and years, centuries, for people to finally get their head around concepts that were not self-evident or readily apparent. So all of these things that I'm talking about when it comes to the advancement of historiography, drawing links between cause and effect, double-checking information from a variety of sources, appropriately contextualizing fragmented details, we do these things every day, not just in the field of history, but they were not always as simple and as obvious as they may seem to be. Someone had to think of them, figure out that they were important, work out the best way to do them, and then get other people on board with them as well. And that is quite aside from less obvious principles of historiography, the correct use of primary sources, accounting for systemic biases, etc., etc.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Anyway, as we move now from the Middle East and into Europe, still in the medieval period here, we can start to talk about the historiography of medieval Christendom as opposed to that of the Islamic world. And oh boy, if you thought the Muslims put too much religion into their historiography, hold on to your hats, because the Christians gave them a run for their money. Medieval Christian historiography was from top to bottom theological in nature. History as a discipline was so overtly religious in medieval Christendom that it's not really possible to talk about history without it being religious in some manner during this time period. And there's a very good reason for this. The reason that history and religion were so tightly bound from the outset in the Christian world is that the people writing the history, those who were educated enough to read and write on an academic level, were invariably members of the religious clergy. Priests and monks, they were the ones writing the books, and so it naturally follows that religion pervaded every aspect of written histories from this place and this period. Literature in general, not just historical literature, it had an overwhelmingly religious bent to it in medieval Europe. The overwhelming majority of medieval European written works are religious in nature. And again, it makes sense. In medieval Europe, intellectual pursuits like writing books were almost exclusively in the wheelhouse of the Christian clergy. But the end result of all of this from a historiographical standpoint was the production of a lot of theological history, with Christian scholars again attempting to reconcile their religious mythology with real-world history, particularly the historicity of the New Testament. Bit of a fool's errand once again, and unfortunately that wasn't the only way that European historiography was behind the times, because in the early medieval period especially, historians mainly produced annals, and chronologies. Once again, just timelines with very little in the way of analysis or evaluation. Works such as the famous Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And while things did develop, medieval Europeans didn't get too far past basic things like biographies of famous figures and accounts of major wars. There was very, very little in the way of social or cultural history, for instance, in contrast to the Islamic world, where historiography advanced much, much more swiftly. And additionally, as is so often the case, accuracy fell by the wayside when it came to some historians just wanting to tell a good story. The best example of this is the body of historical work written on the Crusades, such as the epic poem The Song of Antioch. Accounts like these were generously based on a true story, I think you can say. Exactly the sort of historical fiction we see so often these days. And look, they still offer some historical insight into the time period, and they're still somewhat useful as historical sources. But they certainly do not give accurate or proper accounts of actual people and actual events. They do not let the truth get in the way of a good story. Overall, Europe did not do a particularly good job when it comes to the historiography of its medieval period. This historiography lacks rigor, it lacks breadth, it lacks accuracy, and was very heavily dominated by the religious agenda of the church, as well as what is essentially just historical fiction. However, as we move now from the medieval period and into the Renaissance and the following modern period, modern as in between the 17th and 19th centuries, not modern as in right now, Europe would, as it did in many other scientific and academic areas as the Enlightenment period took hold, it would move to the front of the pack. Italian historians during the Renaissance period began to learn the more advanced techniques of historians from the East, and they would adopt these techniques in addressing European history, and this refreshed the culture of European historiography, just as Italian Renaissance artists and musicians and scientists and whatever else brought about changes in European art and music and science and culture and all the rest of it. I don't want to spend too much time in the Renaissance period, however, because I want to get into the modern period, into the 17th and 18th centuries here, to talk about some of the most important figures in historiography from this time in history. With the Age of Enlightenment in full swing, with European scholars and scientists now asking all new questions and finding all new answers about the world, human advancement sped up like never before. All manner of scientific and academic disciplines developed extremely quickly, and historiography was one of them. Thanks to people like the famous French philosopher Voltaire, who brought a new sense of rationalist critical analysis to European history. Following in the footsteps of predecessors like Liu Ziji and Ibn Khaldun, Voltaire approached historical writing with a focus on accuracy, verifiability, and, notably when it comes to European history, rationalism. Despite being religious himself, Voltaire rejected the supernatural in his historical writings and was highly critical of medieval Europe's historiography as a result. Instead, he more or less began anew, reinvestigating historical affairs from the beginning, again, taking nothing for granted, drawing objective conclusions from verifiable sources. This approach, already firmly established in other parts of the world beforehand, it would help to revolutionize European historiography, but Voltaire didn't stop there. Just as some of the other historians we've spoken about did, Voltaire also opened the door in Europe to social and cultural history, to economic history, scientific history, instead of just focusing again on political and military history, on prominent leaders and great battles. In fact, we can hear from Voltaire himself. Here is what he wrote to describe his approach to historiography. My chief object is not political or military history. It is the history of the arts, of commerce, of civilization, of the human mind. He also wrote, "One demands of modern historians more details, better ascertained facts, precise dates, more attention to customs, laws, mores, commerce, finance, agriculture, population." And broadly speaking, Voltaire held himself to the standard he set. The historical works that he produced are amongst the finest of the era. Although I will say, despite telling historians not to let their own personal biases creep into their work, he certainly did let his own personal biases creep into his work, as, well, honestly, in exactly the same way that I do, interestingly enough. A strong current of anti-religious sentiment is woven through much of Voltaire's historical works. Looks like, looks like I've got a lot in common with Voltaire, absolute genius that he was. Although I will very firmly state at this point that I'm not an out-and-out unapologetic racist like Voltaire was. I will put that one on record if we're going to make a comparison there. Anyway, some other groundbreaking figures I want to mention from the modern period in Europe. David Hume, in 1754, he published a work called The History of England, and this was a literal textbook example of the strides that European historiography had made. It was a massive and all-encompassing work. The History of England, it covers the history of England from the classical period when Rome invaded all the way through to the end of the 17th century. It is such an ambitious work, tremendous in its scope. It attempts to cover all aspects of English history, not just political and military. As I say, Hume's work was cultural, social. It involved the history of English science and literature and philosophy and so much more. It did have plenty of critics, mind you. Thomas Jefferson hated it so much he banned it from the University of Virginia's libraries. But whether you agree with it or not, what the history of England showed was just how developed European historiography had become. And it wasn't just a history of England that demonstrated this. I very quickly want to tell you about Edward Gibbon and his magnum opus, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. A colossal work that is greatly admired for the quality of its writing, its objectivity, its verifiability, and the excellent use of source material. In fact, Gibbon's careful use of primary sources would go on to be enormously influential in the discipline of historical studies, as he demonstrated how they can be used effectively and responsibly in the creation of stupendous historical texts. You can tell I'm a big fan of Gibbon as well. He too held strongly anti-religious views, which helped. It did two things, right? One, fantastic, helped to continue the secularization of history. Love that. But also, I do have to admit, it did rather significantly compromise the quality of his work, because his central argument in Decline and Fall is that the Roman Empire collapsed due to its wholesale conversion to Christianity, which is not quite correct. No. The Roman Empire fell due to barbarian incursions, political corruption, an unsustainable slave-based economy, the division of East and West, declining military power, a host of other factors. The conversion to Christianity was not really what did it. But again, it's what I was saying, right? Historians are always trying, whether they realize it or not, to push an agenda on you. They're always attempting to influence you in some way. I try to be open about the fact that I am like that when I do it. I don't try to hide my political biases particularly strongly, much to the chagrin of some listeners, but much to the delight of others I know. So it is something to keep in mind. Even the best historian, even the most widely lauded and celebrated historians like Gibbon, right, still have an agenda that they're attempting to push on you. And that's something that you do have to remember when addressing this entire discipline. Anyway, even if Gibbon's conclusions aren't thoroughly sound, you can't fault his methodology. The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire is a historical masterpiece. It set a new standard for historians everywhere, and it resulted in Gibbon being referred to by some as the first modern historian. But let's keep going here and move now into the 19th century, where historiography began to feel the strong influence of a new force altogether. We've talked about the way religion influenced the work of historians, how their attempts to reconcile myth with fact and present findings that pleased powerful religious movements has contributed to the development of historiography over the years. Well, in the 19th century, there was a new type of powerful movement that historians had to start to cater towards, and these were the various nationalist movements that cropped up. Nationalism emerged across the 19th century in a big way, and historians were just one of many types of people called up to support various nationalist efforts. And the role of the historian in a nationalist movement is a very important one indeed, as we'll talk about right now, because it is historians that are the custodians of a nation's story, its origins, its ethos, and as such, historians have a lot of influence in how nations perceive themselves, as well as, of course, how they are perceived by others. Take a second now to think about your nation, right? Your nation and its history, and how that history is packaged up and presented, not just within your nation, but to the world. So Australia, for instance. Australia is a friendly, a relaxed country, a lucky country, where people are treated fairly, where we value things like opportunity alongside helping out a mate in need. These stereotypes about our country, they come from our history. Our origins as a British colony, the experience of the European settler, the wealth on offer to the working man in the wake of the gold rush, our formation as a united country, the role we played in the world wars, Gallipoli, the Ashes, Hey Hey It's Saturday, a budding snag, this is Australia, this is us, this is our history. When people think of Australia, they think of barbecues and surfing and the great outdoors, a sunburnt country where everyone gets a fair go. Broadly speaking, Australia is not stereotyped as a backwards, racist nation, as a nation built upon the suffering of Indigenous people and non-white immigrants, because, for better or worse, these are the stories our historians have told us. This is what we were taught in school. These are the ideas we absorb. We learn about our boys over in Gallipoli. We don't learn about the systemic racism of the White Australia policy. And it's not just Australia. Think about the common stereotypes of any major nation and think about how that nation's history plays into that. The British still behaving like Britannia rules the waves. The USA still unpicking a hopelessly tangled historical legacy of systematized racism. The point I'm trying to make here is that historians are, in many ways, the gatekeepers of national identity. And if you're not convinced of this, if you're not convinced that history is that important in a country's national identity, let me ask you this. What's the first thing that comes into your mind when you think about the nation of Germany? The 19th century represented a colossal shift in the direction that history as a discipline began to take, as people untethered themselves from royal and noble houses and instead awoke to their own national identities. And the way this was supported was through history and the work of historians, which had a huge impact on the way that historians developed their craft. Many historians produced works that served a nationalistic purpose in attempting to establish or underpin a national identity or national values or a sense of national belonging. And nowhere is this more evident than in the United States of America, whose obsession with its own history began at the outset of the 19th century as it determinedly attempted to establish itself as an independent nation distinct from its colonial British origins. American historians conjured a vast national mythos almost from thin air, overnight, one that impacts the entire world to this very day, of course, with the United States still remaining a hegemonic superpower in the 21st century. But nationalist historiography was very much present in other parts of the world as well during the 19th century, in developing or emerging nations that were seeking establishment or independence or unification. The unification of nations like Germany and Italy in the 19th century, these political movements relied upon a historical mythos to establish nationhood, to create a sense of togetherness and belonging, a new identity for people to attach themselves to. And this new influence on historians, it had a strong impact, and not necessarily a positive one, on the progress of historiography. Accuracy, verifiability, and truth, these could all be put aside to serve the needs of a nationalist agenda, or, at the very least, the facts could be presented in a way that suited a nationalist perspective. For instance, what were once traitorous rebels could instead be recast in a new light as valiant freedom fighters, for instance. Now, look, I'm not saying that all historians of the period were guilty of this. Many were not. Many great historical works were created in the 19th century, but I'm trying to instead illustrate to you the push and pull felt by historians as the way that their motivations spur them to create works in different ways. And again, I myself am guilty of this. My personal beliefs inform my motivations in making this podcast, in selecting what to talk about each week and also how to talk about it. And I'm motivated by many different things. An interest in history, of course, a desire to entertain, the feeling that I should promote certain political views, like when I dressed up an entire episode on Australian constitutional referendums just so I could tell people to vote yes last year. And another motivation that I need to admit here, one that has become stronger than ever before in the last year or so, based on the changes that have taken place, the decisions that I've made, I am now very, very strongly motivated by money. I now need the podcast to succeed in order to maintain my own financial security. So the history that I choose to showcase and the way in which I choose to showcase it, this is often influenced by how well I think an episode will go in terms of listeners and therefore ad revenue. Hence, things like the Oppenheimer episode coming out when the film did, or even last week, an episode about Shogun while the TV show is so popular. I do like to think that I can maintain a level of integrity and bring stories to you that are still worth being told. But the fact of the matter is that I, like every historian out there, tinpot or no, we have our own set of personal biases, influences, and motivations that necessarily impact the work we produce, even if we sit here telling ourselves that they don't, that we're above it, that we can be impartial and objective and all the rest of it. It doesn't matter. You cannot extract a personal bias that absolutely when talking about something like history. And these biases were, as I say, very clearly put on display throughout the 19th century when nationalist sentiments emerged around the globes, especially across the Americas and throughout Europe. Historians supported nationalist movements with the cut and thrust of their work, contributing to the foundation of national mythos that still inform concepts of nationhood in various places around the world, still through to this very day. But it wasn't just nationalism that would have such a massive influence on historiography in the 19th century. If we're going to talk about huge changes in this discipline throughout the 19th century, we have to talk about a certain fellow by the name of Karl Marx. Karl Marx and his immensely important work, Das Kapital, revolutionized aspects of historiography with the introduction of Marx's philosophical approach to historical analysis known as historical materialism. Historical materialism is an analysis of history that revolves around class structures and the way that labor and wealth have been used and distributed as our civilization has developed. And according to Marx, class conflict is at the very heart of the history of the human species, and so Marxist readings of history completely reshape the way that history can be analyzed and evaluated. Marx's historical materialism holds that class struggle is a unifying constant. It's present throughout all of human history. It is a thread that runs through our entire existence as a species. And whether you agree with Marx or not, his introduction of classist principles into historical thought would change history, and not just history, but the future as well, and not just history, but also historiography and our relationship with history. So, whether classist, nationalist, or whatever else, many historians picked sides during the 19th century and produced works in support of these political groups. And of course, there were more historians than ever before. More people could read than ever before. More people could write than ever before. More things had happened than ever before. So there was just more history, more people writing about history, and more things happening for them to write about. And this meant more perspectives were available, more ideas, more concepts, more of everything. Way too much for us to get into comprehensively here. But the point I want to make is that in the 19th century, an important development in historiography was that objectivity was compromised by many historians who sought a specific purpose in what they wrote. As history was re-evaluated and reinterpreted, historiography lost a level of objectivity, but it gained a new level of flexibility in being able to look at history in all new and sometimes extremely radical ways. And in the late 19th century, this was, I believe at least, a contributing factor to one of the most crucial developments ever to take place in historiography, the professionalization of history. In the back half of the 19th century, historians, particularly in Germany, began to systematize the discipline like never before. History became more and more of a science as it took its place amongst other academic disciplines in the great universities, again, particularly in Germany, but broadly all across Europe and beyond. And there is one bloke who is perhaps more important than anyone else in the professionalization of history, a fella by the name of Leopold von Ranke. Ranke was an enormously influential 19th century historian, a pioneering figure in the world of historical academia.
He developed new techniques for teaching history, for archival research, for engaging readers with narrative history. He was famous for enforcing strict standards with the use and analysis of primary sources. Ranke set the tone for academic historians across the 19th century, and while many were being pushed or pulled in this or that direction, he and those that followed his school of thoughts retained and developed the objectivity, the rigour, and the dispassionate rationalism that proper historical studies require. By the end of the 19th century, history faculties could be found in universities everywhere, and perhaps due to their ironclad devotion to objectivity, facts and figures, being truthful and correct, they may have begun to develop the lasting reputation for dull, soporific stuffiness that plagues history to this very day. In any case, the professionalisation of history set the stage for the historiography of the 20th century, which saw a sharp division emerge between the professional historian and the amateur. Professional historians with fancy academic titles and those weird elbow patches on their jackets, they monopolised legitimate historical output from their universities, while amateurs just poked away at whatever they found interesting, and specific schools of history emerged. Historians united by a common perspective on how to evaluate history itself. Empirical, idealistic, Marxist, nationalist, structuralist, post-colonial, interdisciplinarian, the list goes on. And obviously there's no way that we can talk about all of these. The important point here is that now, with so many people studying history in so many different ways, a huge diversity in methodologies on how best to address the discipline began to emerge. And this, of course, developed historiography even further and went hand in hand with other academic disciplines as well in terms of how history was investigated. For instance, new understandings in statistics and data analysis allowed for a more quantitative approach to evaluating history, while advancements in scientific inquiry allowed for new understandings of historical scientific progress. I suppose the best way to sum up what I'm trying to say here is that the 20th century saw the diversification of history as an academic pursuit. As more and more people analysed more and more history in more and more ways than ever before. But the 20th century also saw a few other things happen that would lead to great change in the world of historiography. Firstly, the increasing interconnectedness of humanity all around the world with the advent of new technology. Long-distance communication, faster transportation methods, etc. This led to the beginnings of an era of globalization, which in turn led to world history, taking a focus like never before. Much of the historiography of the 20th century is concerned with the analysis of human history as a whole, across the world, rather than just in specific areas or regions. And this ties into the second thing that I wanted to mention, the colossal, unprecedented global conflicts that dominated the first half of the 20th century. The world wars changed history, and they changed the history of history, as is so readily apparent whenever you dip your toes into today's popular history and realize the overwhelming majority of it is just interminable Second World War documentaries. I'm not trying to downplay the historical significance of the Second World War, not by any means, but you may have noticed just how much history there is out there these days that is solely focused on this conflict alone. It is enormously overrepresented in popular history. Films, TV shows, podcasts, books. History as a discipline seems to be mainly concerned with the Second World War, on the surface level at least. I don't know. That's the impression you might get when you visit the history section of a bookshop or type history into YouTube. Or so you would think. I actually did type history into YouTube, and look at me go, checking my sources. Maybe I'm a real historian after all. The top result is actually the official music video for the One Direction song, History. So, yeah, might have been a bit wrong there. Oops. Anyway, in any case, the World Wars would have a monumental impact on historiography, dominating the discipline and resulting in the most prodigious output of historical material. One of the reasons, as alert listeners may have noticed, that I actually don't tend to do many episodes on the Second World War. One, because there's already a huge amount of stuff out there on the Second World War, and two, because as I mentioned before, my main objective with this podcast is to entertain, and the Second World War, with a death toll of 80 million, with nuclear weapons, with the advent of fascism, and with the consequent Holocaust, well, just, you know, isn't very entertaining, I think it's fair to say. I don't think that's much of a hot take. Anyway, the closer we come to the present day, the more diversified and specialized historical studies become. Today, There are historical schools like post-structuralist history, feminist history, environmental history. While world history is a more commonly studied subject than ever before in our increasingly globalized world. And of course, digital technology plays more and more of a role in modern historiography, with digital archives and records, with the computer-based analysis of historical sources and data. And perhaps most notably for you right here and now, the presentation and dissemination of historical material. And it's this last aspect of modern historiography, the most recent and, as far as I'm concerned, the most important aspect, that has defined my relationship with the discipline, and if you're a regular listener, very likely yours as well. I love history, I always have, but even the greatest lover of history can't deny that it has a long-standing problem with the perception that it's boring. History classes are slow and soporific, history books are dull and monotonous. The whole discipline is, as I've said a few times in this episode, it's all about names and dates and facts and figures. We reward students of history for the memorization of objective truths. Julius Caesar was assassinated on the Ides of March. Christopher Columbus sailed to the New World in 1492. Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo in 1815. And these objective truths tragically miss the point of what history actually is. By miles and miles, they don't really tell us anything. History, at its most simple, is just a collection of the best stories that humanity as a civilization has collected. And we love stories. Our parents read to them as we went to bed each night. We tell them to our friends every day. We sit and read or watch or listen to them for pleasure and entertainment. So why then has history, the guardian of the best stories from across our existence as a species, why has history become known as boring and tedious, as unimaginative and passionless and uninteresting? My belief, and a big part of why I do this podcast, is that it is not what history presents, but how history presents it. It doesn't really matter that Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. It's handy to know that, sure, but that's not the important part. The important part is the great reverberations that his defeat at the Battle of Waterloo sent out across the vast span of consequent human history. Napoleon's downfall at the Battle of Waterloo led to the political restructure of most of Europe at the Congress of Vienna, which led to the rise of the great powers of Europe throughout the 19th century, which led to ongoing political and military tensions across the continent and its empires, which led to the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which led to the outbreak of the First World War, which led to the outbreak of the Second World War, which led to an unprecedented acceleration of the investigation into nuclear physics in search of the atom bomb, which led to the post-war establishment of the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, which led to a bloke named Tim Berners-Lee, while working there as a contractor, to come up with an idea that would go on to become the World Wide Web, which led to the existence of the internet as we know it today, which led to you downloading and listening to this podcast here and now. That is interesting. And to me, that is history. It's not the names and the dates. It's the causes and effects, the stories that interlink with one another, the connection that we have as a species through our joint and separate histories. How can these histories be anything other than fascinating when they make us who we are as individuals, as a civilization? So I'm very, very grateful to be able to sit down each week to read and to write and to speak about history, about what I find interesting and entertaining and important, about what I also hope you'll find interesting and entertaining and important. I'm speaking very seriously when I tell you that it is a great and a humbling privilege to be a part of your life in this way. For you to allow me to share my researches, my perspectives, my voice and my values with you week in and week out for what is now a total of 300 different times. I can't hope to pretend that this episode is complete. It never could be. The history of history is unending. It's infinite. Even between sitting down to write this episode and speaking these words here and now, vast, uncountable new histories have come into being. The scribbling of notes on the margins of a politician's speech, the whir and hum of an impossibly advanced piece of laboratory equipment, the ear-splitting crack of gunfire in a war zone, the birth of someone who, unknown to us all today, will grow in time to shape the course of human history. Or just the funny text you sent to the group chat about the unbelievable thing that just happened to you, or a phone call you make to your mum just to hear how her day had been. That is history. And I can't possibly hope to encapsulate everything that history was, that history is, and that history will be in a single episode of a Tin Pot podcast. But what I can do, very sincerely, is thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And thank you for sharing in my passion for history each and every week. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the history of it's not really it's a history of history. I think we can safely land there. Anyway, once again, I want to say just how deep my appreciation is for you as an alert listener, as someone who has been here for however long it is you've been here, whether you started listening with episode one or even maybe just last week, episode 299. It really is so humbling to be part of so many people's weekly routines, and I can't really properly express the depth of gratitude and appreciation I have for all the listeners who continue to tune in to listen to this Tin Pot History podcast. So thank you so very, very much. Anyway, that's enough of that nonsense. It's now time to move on to the announcements. I know many people have been waiting a long time to hear this, and I don't want to keep you waiting any longer. First up, the announcement I didn't expect to be making this week. I didn't tease this last week because I didn't think it would be ready, but it is, and I'm very pleased to announce to you, particularly if you're a listener in Australia or over in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that a new merch shop for Half-Assed History is already open, up and running, ready to go. I'm pleased to say that I have partnered with a company called The Print Bar. They're based in Melbourne and Brisbane over here in Australia. And they've been terrific. So far, they've been fantastic to work with. It's been really, really excellent setting up the new shop with them. And as I know the majority of the listening audience is based in Australia, I'm pleased to say that now you'll be able to head to that shop and not pay approximately $1 billion in shipping fees. So I want to thank TeePublic as well. TeePublic have been terrific. The only real issue I've had with TeePublic is the complaints I've had from listeners about the shipping costs. That's not TeePublic's fault. They're not based in Australia. It costs a lot to ship stuff internationally. But now, if you're a listener in Australia, if you're a listener over across the ditch, you can head over to halfasthistory.theprintbar.com and you can find a selection of merch. None of it's really new, I will say. It's mainly just stuff that is available on the TeePublic website. But I'll tell you this, it's bloody cheap. It's quite cheap. The t-shirts are $30 at the moment. There's a couple of other bits and pieces on there. The prices may go up. I don't know. Not making a huge amount of money on, which is fine. That isn't the priority. The main thing is just that they exist. But I do feel it fair to warn you that those prices may go up. And if you're wanting to grab some stuff at this potentially reduced price, now's the time to do it. $30 for a t-shirt. So head over there and let me know your feedback on the website, what it's like, you know, the checkout process, when the stuff arrives, what it's like. The other partner in this arrangement is a Kiwi company called AS Colour. I made the decision to go with them after researching a lot of different options pretty thoroughly, and AS Colour did seem to be the best option in terms of sustainable and ethical fashion. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that as well. But yes, halfasthistory.theprintbar.com for all of your Half-Assed History merchandising needs if you are in this part of the world. And for international listeners across in Europe and the Americas, and anywhere else for that matter, I would say to you that the TeePublic website is going to be open for another month at least, but then I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it. I'm not even sure if I'm supposed to have two merch shops. I really don't know at this stage, but I do want to give listeners a chance, particularly how sort of abrupt and surprising this announcement has been. I don't want to just close up the TeePublic shop in case anyone has been putting off a purchase from there, but I will say time is probably finite for you to do so. So the other thing is TeePublic have a wider range of products available than the Print Bar, which is fine. You can still get a mug, you can still get a, you know, you can get a t-shirt, whatever else at the print bar. But some of the other stuff, some of the weirder stuff, cushions and whatever else, probably won't be available once the TeePublic shop closes. So if you've had your eye on something from TeePublic, head over there before it's too late and grab whatever you need. But for all of your needs in the future, particularly, as I say, if you're down here in Australia and don't want to pay those painful shipping costs internationally, head over to halfhousehistory.theprintbar.com. And very, very keen to hear your feedback. Let me know what you think of the website and everything else. And thank you very much to the Print Bar for picking me up and hosting Half House History's merchandise shop. As I say, a pleasure to work with so far, and hopefully things continue on in that vein. But now, my friends, we come to the big one. The big announcement. Last week I teased this announcement by saying it was something that I have been dreading doing. It is something that I've been put off. I've been put off doing it, and I've also been putting off doing it for a very long time. But I have finally bit the bullet, and I am finally going to launch Half-Assed History's social media channels. Man, I didn't want to do this, but many, many people who know a lot more than me about this business have told me that it is more or less a necessity. It's one of the reasons that I haven't been able to get a book deal, apparently. And yes, Half-Assed History is now available on all of your... at the age of 34, my friends, I signed up for TikTok. So that's how things are going at my end. I hope it's worth something to you. Anyway, no, TikTok.com/halfassedhistory, Instagram.com/halfassedhistory. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with Twitter or X as it is these days. I don't know if people use it, if it's worth setting something up. I will be honest with you and tell you that the main reason is that Half-Assed History doesn't fit, because you can only have 15 characters in a Twitter username. So it would be Half-Assed Histore, which already exists, or maybe Half-Assed History without the O. I don't know. Anyway, I'll figure it out. But for now, you can head over to TikTok, you can head over to Instagram, and you can like, comment, and subscribe if you want. You certainly don't have to. My aim is to post, I'll start off with like 3 videos a week. And it's not going to be hugely groundbreaking stuff. It's just going to be little hooks and intros to old episodes, you know, telling people about some of the funny and silly things from history that they can go back and listen to. So, I don't know, if you're a rusted on listener, it'll remind you of some of your favorites. If you're someone who's just discovering the show, it'll help you, it'll point you into towards the direction of some of the ones that, you know, aren't complete stinkers. And hopefully it'll help to build a bit more of an audience moving forward. But yeah, look, it's been a huge learning curve. Last couple of weeks I've spent talking to people a lot younger and a lot smarter than me about, just what an Instagram reel is, because that's not something I knew. So that's fun. anyway, a little bit embarrassing to, becoming so brazenly face-to-face with my increasing cultural irrelevance. But I don't know, as a student of history, I should recognize that that's just what happens. Everything comes to an end. But it's a beginning right now for the Half-Assed History social media empire. So do go and do me a favor. Do go and follow these accounts if you have even the remotest interest in doing so. I'm hoping it'll grow the show. But the main thing, really, to speak really honestly with you about why I'm doing this, is because I was told in no uncertain terms that a book publisher will evaluate the success and the popularity of a podcast by how big of a social media footprint it has. And so if I want a book deal, I need tens of thousands of followers. So if you feel like it, go and follow on Instagram and TikTok if you want. You don't have to. I will certainly understand if you don't want to. I wouldn't. But if you do want to a little bit of extra bonus Riley content in your life, then you can head over there. And also, for many of you, maybe it might be the first time you actually get to see what I look like. Although, I wouldn't get my hopes up there. Certainly nothing special. Anyway, if you have any sort of expertise or knowledge or wisdom when it comes to social media, please, please, please send me a feedback. Let me know how I'm doing with the whole general deal of the channels. I was advised, I was talking to some people at Acast who were very, very helpful. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Guy at Acast for talking me through and walking me through a lot of the process behind setting up a social media presence. But in particular, I want to thank them for the very, very stark warnings they gave me about making sure that the channels aren't cringe. This is something that I understand is very, very important for social media to avoid, particularly on TikTok. So if you do see that at any stage I am veering towards being cringe, please let me know, because I would never want to. I would never want to become that. I'm comfortable with the level of cultural irrelevance, but the idea of becoming cringe, absolutely no. Please no. Please never, never, never a fate that I want to experience. So let me know what your thoughts are. Send through any feedback you've got, or any tips on best practices, or what I should or shouldn't be doing. Looking forward to hearing what people think. Got to get those numbers up, rookie numbers in this game, quite literally at this stage. Although I will congratulate the 10 people on Instagram who discovered that I had had created the account before this episode went live. So well done. We've got some real hardcore Half-Ass History fans out there already following the show on Instagram before the accounts were even launched. But while we're in the business of plugging external websites for the show, there is, of course, Patreon. Patreon.com/halfasshistory. Thank you to everyone who has supported me for, boy oh boy, years and years and years in some cases now. In particular, actually, I want to take this occasion, the 300th episode, to shout out a couple of listeners who have been with me quite literally from the start. And these listeners are people who have maintained their support on Patreon since it launched. Some of them, I know, have been listening since episode number one. And after 300, they're still coming back for more. So I don't know what's going on with them. But I want to thank Philip Müller, Derek Carlson, Jacob Zhao, Tom Calvert. I don't know. Mispronouncing names is a proud tradition of this podcast. So I'm sorry, Tomo. April King, Bob Jacobs, Graham Keenan, and Belgian Bart. Bart van Geluwe. I'm so sorry, Bart. So sorry, old mate. I really should have looked it up again, how to pronounce it. I'll get there. I'll probably never get there one day. Anyway, these exalted members of the Half-Ass History Old Guard have been with the show essentially since it began, and I'm so deeply appreciative of your continued support. I owe you a great debt of gratitude, as indeed to I owe to every single listener tuning in for the first time or the 300th time. I don't take a single one of you for granted. I work very hard to, despite what the show's title is, I work very hard to make this podcast the best that it can be. And I'm very flattered that you continue to show up week in and week out for more of my nonsense, and that you continue to tell your friends, tell your enemies, and tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent. And now you can do it with the magic of social media. You don't even have to have a conversation with these people anymore. You can just DM them a link and be done with it. So, the success of this show rests upon the fact that people have been out there telling others about the show, beating the Half-Ass History drum. And I'll never be able to repay the debt of gratitude I have to each and every listener who keeps showing up every week for more nonsense. So here's to another 300 episodes. Thank you for being a pivotal part of the success of this Tin Pot History podcast. And I look forward to your company in a great many future episodes. And also, I hope, in the not too distant future, your company in person at live shows and your company on your bookshelves when I finally get a bloody book deal, mate. Honestly, if you want a Half-Ass History book, please go and follow the show on TikTok and Instagram. Apparently, that's the only language that publishers speak when it comes to podcasting book deals. So I really have got to get those numbers up. These rookie numbers, mate. It's not going to happen otherwise. Anyway, do let me know what you think, what you thought of the episode. Let me know what you think of the social media channels, halfasshistory.net. Of course, use the contact form there to get in touch. That's the best way to do it. And while we're talking about getting in touch, there is one listener here that I want to shout out, because I get so many emails, right? I get hundreds and hundreds of emails a week. But there is one bloke whose emails, I have to say, stand above the rest. And so maybe there'll be listeners out there who take this as a challenge. Maybe it could be you who unseats this particularly alert listener sending me in terrific emails almost every week. And that listener is none other than Eric Whedon. Eric, mate, thank you so much for being part of the Half-Ass History community. Thank you so much for the long, detailed, thoughtful, and very entertaining emails you send me so often. I don't know how you have time to do anything else, to be honest. It is terrific to hear from you every single time. And look, if you want to unseat old mate Weedo from the top spot as the podcast's preferred correspondent, halfasshistory.net, send me through those emails. I'm looking forward to hearing from you.
And in addition to Eric, obviously everyone else who writes in and week out, it is great to hear from you. And I apologize that I can't get back to everyone because, again, it is just a question of volume. I'm a victim of my own success when it comes to my overwhelming correspondence. Anyway, thanks for being here once again, and thank you for putting up with what was probably the most self-indulgent episode I've ever made. We return to our normal programmed listening next week, so looking forward to having your company then. And as we've talked about social media, as we've talked about TikTok, oh, also Facebook. I did sign up for Facebook as well, facebook.com/halfasshistory. So for all the boomers listening, you can, you know, in the middle of liking pictures of your grandkids, you can follow us. Sorry, I shouldn't come at you so hard. I remember when Facebook was cool, man. I remember when Facebook was the place to be, but I shouldn't come at Facebook users so hard. But if you do want to follow the show on Facebook, if I haven't completely put you off, you can do exactly that. I will say it's going to be exactly the same content across all the social channels. I'm not differentiating it at all. I'm going to make one video and post it to every single channel, and it'll be the same everywhere. But you know, I'm again open to feedback. Want to hear what your thoughts, expectations, or advice would be when it comes to managing social media platforms. So do let me know. Anyway, that is that. Finally, we're going to wrap things up, of course. And as I say, as we've been talking about social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and the like, we have a question posed on Reddit to do with one of these social media channels. It comes to us from Scary Moose, who asks, what would Instagram have been called in the olden days before the development of the metric system?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.